This event was recorded live as a part of the Cleveland Council on World Affairs Foreign Policy Forum. Faisal Attani joined us to discuss 60 Years Later, an exploration into the Syrian Civil War. Please visit ccwa.org to learn more about our upcoming speaker series programs.
Good evening. Thank you, Ambassador, for the very kind introduction, and thank you to the Cleveland Council on World Affairs for having me here, and to all of you for making it tonight on a Monday evening for your interest. I've been invited, thank you, to speak on the most complicated conflict in the world. So this is, to begin with, let me caveat by saying this is very much a moving target of a conflict. So what it looks like today may not be what it looks like tomorrow, much less next week. So what I'll try to do is capture sort of the big picture of things as much as I can, and then maybe describe a snapshot at a point in time, which is all I can do really about Syria, which is right now. I'll touch on an overview of the war itself, the role of international actors in that war. Of course, we'll talk about the international coalition against ISIS and how that's going. And we'll wrap up by maybe discussing what some of the effects are of U.S. policy under President Donald Trump. So before I go any further, let me just say, and I know there are strong opinions about the war in Syria, especially those of you who are from the region. That's understandable. I'm not going to talk about my opinion now. I'm just going to give you an analysis, not a sort of prescription of what I think should happen or shouldn't have happened or all this stuff. It's not really value added for you, and I'm happy to talk about that later, but for now, I'll keep it analytical and maybe kind of lay the foundation for the discussion afterwards. So with that caveat, analysis, not opinion, let me say a few words about where I think things stand. It's important to keep in mind, for those of you who don't follow this every day, there are many, many dimensions to this war. The dimension you probably hear most about is ISIS and the war against ISIS. That's certainly an important dimension, but it's just one of them. There are many others that are sort of slightly lower below the radar and others that are obvious. One other one is the competition between the United States and Iran for influence in Syria. This conflict is partly that, although not completely. There's also a U.S.-Russian competition, not over Syria as such, but a kind of zero-sum global competition going on between the United States and Russia. There is a competition between Turkey, to Syria's north, and the Syrian Kurds, who are seeking political autonomy of some sort. There's also fighting between the various anti-Assad rebel groups. And then there's the backers of those rebel groups fighting each other through the groups. That can be regional backers or international backers, the Gulf states, Turkey, America. And all of this at some point or the other intersects with the anti-ISIS war in very, very complicated ways. But the core of the matter, the conflict that allows all these other conflicts to take place, is still the one between the Syrian government and the insurgency. And that's the kind of fundamental core conflict, so that's where I'll begin. Let me first spell out the broad alignments of this war. The most consistent alignment has been Russia and Iran backing Bashar al-Assad and his regime. That hasn't really wavered throughout the conflict. It's been there from day one and it's climbed. Now, Russia is obviously a major diplomatic player in the Syrian process. It's partly that because it's a powerful country, but partly also because it actually wants to use its gains on the ground through Bashar al-Assad to kind of create diplomatic leverage against the United States and actually against other regional rivals as well. Unlike the Iranians, which have kind of come across as a pariah state internationally, the Russians can do this. The Iranians can't really do this, despite the fact that they're very, very heavily involved operationally in the military effort on the regime's side. So while you may see kind of Russia as the high-profile diplomatic player, which it is, operationally at the military level, the Iranians are more embedded in the military effort than the Russians are. How? Firstly, because the Iranians have helped set up very large kind of pro-government militias inside Syria, tens of thousands we're talking. And second, because of course it cooperates and directs the militia Hezbollah in Syria, which also fights on behalf of the Syrian government or in cooperation with the Syrian government. So between those two levers, Iran has a lot of influence on the ground. If you switch to the other side and you look at the opposition or the rebels, it's a much more fragmented situation. Turkey, for example, has always had its own favorite rebel groups in the north that it's backed. Lately, it's backed them less and less against Assad and more against the Kurds in the north in order to kind of break their political project there. The United States used to back a large number of smaller rebel groups, both in the north and the south. That isn't really happening anymore. And it's kind of a gradual policy shift that took place in Washington over the past 6 to 12 months. You can say that the United States is no longer a major player in the anti-Assad insurgency. The Saudis and the Qataris have also backed their own guys from time to time. Some of them have been the same as the American forces. Some of them have been actually enemies or rivals of theirs. None of these backers believe that the Syrian insurgency is capable of defeating the Assad regime anymore. That may once have been the case where they believed that. Now the backing is much more about creating leverage for themselves in whatever future Syria ends up emerging from all this, rather than conquering the country and overthrowing the regime. I think there's been a realization over the past couple of years that this isn't possible, at least not at an acceptable cost. What about the war itself? Put simply, and you may hear different versions of this and others may disagree. This is my analysis. My analysis is that the government, Bashar al-Assad, are winning this war against the Syrian rebels. The symbolic turning point of this war was the fall of Aleppo City last year in December, where basically the rebels got encircled by regime forces. They were bombed and besieged, and they ended up just breaking or having to give up. Now, Aleppo was Syria's commercial capital before the war, obviously. And still to now, actually, a vibrant commercial place. So it's very important. And it caused also a lot of rifts within the rebels themselves, the Aleppo issue and how it went. So that kind of weakened the insurgency even more. But the actual turning point, as opposed to the symbolic turning point, was really the Russian entry into this conflict in September, October 2015. By coming in, the Russians brought air power on an unprecedented level that was not there in the conflict before. They brought in experienced and sophisticated military advisors. They brought in some ground troops, but mostly kind of direct the regime's military effort rather than to fight on the front lines, although that did happen sometimes. And they brought in this new strategy of kind of making an area that was controlled by the rebels kind of uncontrollable, unlivable, so that the population of these areas started to turn against the opposition and pressured them to either get out or give up or whatever. And that's actually what ended up happening. It worked to a large extent, and the regime ended up regaining the initiative of this war. So as of now, without going through the military history of the past 2 years, the regime has pacified the majority of territory it had lost to the opposition that it was looking very weak in front of a couple of years ago. It has pretty solid control of the capital, Damascus. There are some rebel pockets outside. They make trouble from time to time, but really, I mean, their future is not very bright. The coastal areas, which are obviously very important because they contain Syrian ports and they contain a lot of Bashar al-Assad's social base in the kind of sectarian sense, although it's not that simple. But anyway, it's very important for him to control this area. It never really came under severe threat, although it was in a bit of trouble, and now it's fine. And Aleppo City is secured, although Aleppo City has some major security and humanitarian and economic problems that haven't been solved yet. What Assad does struggle with, or rather what the regime as a whole struggles with, is capacity. What do I mean by that? It's not just about kind of wrapping up a military battle against one insurgent group at a time. Bashar al-Assad has not been able to solve all of those problems at the same time. So they've had to happen one by one in a kind of a sequence of priority, sequence of capability. He doesn't have the manpower to do it. And a lot of the manpower he does have is in bad shape. He's been fighting for 5 years. They've taken a lot of casualties. And therefore, you know, that hence all the support he's getting from outside. His military situation is still dependent on the situation of the Iranians and the Russians. So he has to fight one fight at a time. And even having fought those places, the question of how to secure so much territory at the same time after the fighting is done, how do you actually bring the rule of law and government back to these areas? That's an open question. So because of these constraints, the regime has picked their battles or managed their battles through one of two ways. The first way is through these so-called reconciliation agreements. which are really, overwhelming the opposition, and the opposition surrenders because militarily it's in a very bad situation. The rebels usually have to hand in at least their heavy weapons. Sometimes they get to keep some light weaponry, sometimes not. The young men of military age tend to either be conscripted into the Syrian army, or they're allowed to leave with their families to a particular spot in Syria, where a lot of these people are have been funneled over the past year or two of fighting. And it's a province in the north called Idlib. It's now largely controlled by an al-Qaeda affiliate. The second model of managing these problems is the de-escalation model. Now, this has much more of an international component to it, because these are deals that are negotiated between the Russians, the Iranians, and the Turks to sort of do localized ceasefires rather than a nationwide ceasefire. An agreement that this area is an area that is no longer going to be an active military front. We're going to leave it alone. It covers a lot of territory, and these agreements cover a lot of key territory in Syria at the moment. The opposition is usually allowed to stay in these places, hence the word ceasefire, rather than having to leave and go elsewhere. It doesn't cover extremist groups. So groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda affiliates are still fair game to everybody, even if they're in those territories. The U.S. hasn't actually really been involved in this process much. With a couple of exceptions, this has been a Russian, Turkish, Iranian process. And maybe for that reason is why it's held more or less well, because these are the powers that have a stake in the fight and influence on the ground. They have caused a significant decrease in violence. That much is true. They're also frequently violated, and there is no clear enforcement mechanism of what you do if somebody violates it, what's the punishment, who punishes, because all of these groups that are agreeing to these ceasefires are actually parties to the conflict, which gives us a problem of enforcement, obviously. One theory and one school of thought is that this is a temporary issue and that the regime is just agreeing to this until it can gather itself well enough to go and take the rest of the opposition territories. The other theory is that actually this is laying the groundwork for a decentralized Syria where opposition groups get to maintain some level of control over certain territories. I don't have an answer to which one this is, but we can talk about it. In any case, this has frozen certain flashpoints of the war. I think at least some of them will be unfrozen once ISIS and Al-Qaeda are weakened, because I can't see it as a genuinely stable situation, but I might be wrong. There is one area that's especially complicated, and it has a lot of international dimensions to it, much more so than the other areas, and that's southern Syria. Why? Well, it's because it borders Israel and Jordan, and that makes it highly strategic for Syria and highly strategic for Israel and Jordan. Right now, it's under a U.S. and Russian-backed de-escalation agreement, sort of a soft ceasefire. There's a lot of Jordanian influence in this area, both from a tribal links between the two countries, as well as the intelligence services of the Jordanians, having studied that landscape really well and penetrated the insurgent groups. As a result of that influence, the Syrian insurgency there in the south sort of agreed to tamp things down under Jordanian pressure. The Jordanians basically wanted to stop refugee flows coming in from Syria into Jordan, so they didn't need another fight over their border. And now they are pursuing reopening the trade routes over land with the Syrian government. And obviously that requires there be some level of peace. So those negotiations are ongoing. The second reason it's complicated is Israel. To the Israelis see this fight in the prism of Iran, the entire war. Before the Israelis, the regime influence in southern Syria is Iran on their border. Whether or not you agree with that, that is genuinely how they see it. And they view this as unacceptable. There are rumors as a result being floated of a 10 to 20 mile border buffer zone being set up in the south that would have no Iranian forces in it, no Hezbollah, etc. That's a delicate situation. Let's see. In any case, right now, regime forces and Iranian-backed militias are in that geography of Syria. And every once in a while, the Israelis attack something or someone in Syria, usually Hezbollah-linked. So much for the core war. around which all the other wars are built. Let's talk about the war that's on the news, the war against ISIS. You'd assume that when everybody can agree on an enemy, then things would be relatively simple going forward. And you would be wrong, because the war on ISIS is also a kind of set of competitions. It is not just a war against a terrorist group. Obviously, there's some simple things and clear things. The regime and its allies are fighting ISIS in some parts of Syria. The United States is fighting ISIS in Syria in partnership with local forces that are pretty much dominated by a Kurdish party called the PYD. There are some Arabs, but that's the general alignment. And Turkey is fighting ISIS in a very particular part of Syria, which it has just basically invaded and occupied, and now it's ruled by Turkish-friendly militias. And those guys are also fighting the Kurds. What makes all this really complicated is that everybody is fighting for different reasons. So the Assad regime wants to retake the country. And so the Assad regime has been fighting a war for 5 years against a broad array of hostile groups, of which ISIS is just one of many. Now the others are being subdued or have been taken care of or contained, but ISIS doesn't have a patron you can go to and ask to put ISIS in a box. So they're not giving up. They have to be fought. Syria's Kurds are using the alliance with America to carve out their own kind of space that would form a basis for an autonomous Kurdish area in northern Syria, in the process killing ISIS. Okay, so the kind of finger, the northeast, and a slight patch next to Aleppo in the northwest, but really like everything northeast of that river is potentially Kurdish territory. Not all of it is inhabited by Kurds. The tip is inhabited by Kurds. Some of it is Arab-Kurdish. Some of it is more Arab than Kurdish, etc. Now, Turkey wants to give potential Kurdish territory to its own allies so that ISIS territory doesn't go to the Kurds. Last but certainly not least, there are all these kind of leftover rebel groups that have understood that they're not going to beat the regime, and they need something to do next, and they want to try to understand what is the balance of power in this country, who's going to win this part of the war, because we need to latch on to that winner. Otherwise, the regime's going to come and get us, or the Americans are going to come and get us, or someone's going to come and get us. So that's a complicated process. So the result is not a joint effort, to put it mildly, it's a race. And as a result of this race, because everybody's kind of trying to take as much as they can as quickly as possible, there have been incidents like the United States shooting down a regime aircraft, or US-backed militias shooting at Iranian militias, or the Russians firing on pro-US or US-backed Kurds, et cetera, et cetera. And all of these are actually within the kind of theater of fighting ISIS. They're not isolated conflicts. The Kurds are still fighting rebel groups that are backed by Turkey. You get the idea. I'm not trying to confuse you for fun. I'm just trying to take the kind of romance. I'm trying to take the romance out of this idea that there's this international coalition that's, we're all agreed we're going to fight ISIS and this is the priority. It's not true. So I'm going to go a bit more into Washington mode and talk about the U.S. role under these two presidents that we've had throughout the Syrian conflict. Now look, for the past 7 years, including this president, U.S. policymakers have warned us about not getting involved in other people's civil wars, not committing to open-ended Middle East conflicts, not stepping onto a slippery slope by going into Syria. Ostensibly, this is the rationale for why we stayed out of Syria, supposedly. Now look, you may or may not support that argument, but the truth of the matter is this is an insincere argument. What the people making it are actually telling you is, we don't want to help the rebels fight Assad. That's in a compartment by itself. Otherwise, we've been at war in Syria since 2014. We've invested in a group in the north of Syria, it's largely Kurdish, that is a sworn enemy of our NATO ally, Turkey. That's one. We have troops on the ground in Syria, hundreds, as far as I know, maybe more. We have 7 military bases in Syria. Now, if you press people on this matter at the Pentagon, they'll tell you, well, we're not sticking around in Syria after we're done with the ISIS job. Let's see. May or may not happen. It's difficult to say how we hang on to these gains if we're not physically there. But then again, no one's articulated whether or not it's worth staying to hang on to them in the first place. We are now in the east of the country fighting in Arab land, not Kurdish land, to make sure that the Kurds take land that we don't want the Iranians and the regime to take. No one has really explained what happens after that or why that is a valuable objective. It may be, but it hasn't been explained. So if you find yourself arguing in favor of the United States staying out of Syria, make sure you know exactly what you mean, because we're already knee-deep in Syria. So with that said, how is our military effort going? Not bad, actually. ISIS has lost a lot of territory over the past year. It lost Mosul, which was the thing that started this whole international level war. Iraq's second largest city. It lost Tal Afar in Iraq as well. It's lost most of the province that contains Raqqa city, which is its supposed capital of the caliphate, where it's now surrounded, and they'll lose that soon. And it lost most of the area around the city of Aleppo in the north to a Turkish-backed coalition of rebel groups. Now, with the loss of territory comes a loss of manpower, comes a loss of resources as well. The populations that you used to tax or take money from, you no longer have. So you lose a lot of revenue streams. You also can't be a caliphate if you don't have territory, goes without saying. So that dream is falling apart. I think ISIS as a sort of strategic regional threat is finished for now, which leaves us with 2 stages to tackle. The first stage is liberating the rest of ISIS-held territory, and there's still quite a bit, particularly east of that river and west of Iraq, in the western Iraq, rather. The main problem, as I said, is the number of people doing the liberating and the fact that many of them are hostile to one another. All of this is only happening in the first place because the U.S. and the Russians have a deconfliction agreement over Syria, where they basically drew a line more or less running along that river, saying, you take the ISIS areas west of that river, don't touch us, we're in the north. Now, look, this has been violated a lot of times already, and there are chances of miscalculations escalating. It's a dangerous situation. You don't hear a lot about it, but at the military level, they're concerned, and they have a lot of kind of near run-ins with the Russians over stuff like that. It also presumes that the Syrian regime, which views this as their country, is going to comply with what the United States thinks it should be doing, which is staying on that side of the river. So it's a delicate situation. The second stage after that is post-ISIS. There will be a post-ISIS stage in Syria. The trouble is, there may or may not be a Syria in a kind of unified political entity sense that can manage this problem. And I don't mean Syria going to split into statelets or no. I just mean a kind of degradation of the regime's institutions and their ability to govern all their territory. The second problem is one that doesn't get a lot of attention, which is reconstruction and how these areas get built. It's a lot of destruction, particularly in the areas that ISIS is holding. We're using a lot of heavy firepower. It's not only a question of how these places get rebuilt. It's also a question of whether it happens at all, actually. Because if you ask the American side of the equation, they will tell you very honestly, we're not interested in doing that. We're going to hand over Raqqa to the PYD and their local allies, and then we'll restore the water surfaces, and then we're walking away. That means that all these refugees who are displaced within Syria and outside Syria are going to have problems coming home. The third problem is, what does the United States do with the territory it takes? Forget Raqqa. Let's talk about everything else, which is about a third of Syria. Does it maintain a military presence? If so, why? And for how long? And what if the Iranians attack it? That's what I'd do if I were the Iranians. And so would they shoot back at them? Would they pull out? That would be pretty disastrous for the United States, etc. Should they just leave and hand it over to the Kurds that have been fighting with them? Well, then what happens? How does Turkey respond to that, to a Kurdish state on its borders? I would think Turkey would respond militarily at some point. So the cities and the empty deserts are the easy thing to take, but this kind of long-term planning is what's not happening. And on that note, we'll wrap up with my final point. Whatever you think of President Donald Trump, or President Barack Obama for that matter, there's been a lot of continuity in policy between these two presidents in Syria, despite what you may kind of hear. The rhetoric is a bit different, and the approach towards the peripheral issues somehow related to Syria or the Middle East, yeah, some of that is different. Trump wants to push back on Iran. Obama wanted a deal with Iran over the nuclear agreement, fine. Obama paid lip service to the idea that the U.S. wanted a political transition in Syria. Donald Trump does not pretend to want that. And President Obama has criticized the Russian role in Syria. President Trump has been supportive in general of that role in Syria. So, despite all that, to all intents and purposes, it's largely the same policy. The policy is to kill ISIS and to cocoon the kill ISIS mission away from all the other wars that are happening around it so that we can finish it as quickly as possible. Even the person running the war, Brett McGurk, from the State Department, the special presidential envoy, is the same guy. So that there was complete continuity of that and of strategy. His approach has been to invest very heavily in the Kurdish forces at the expense of Turkey to try to avoid confronting Russia and Iran and Assad's forces, to stay away from the rebuilding thing, the reconstruction, and to kind of establish a presence on the ground in Syria almost by inertia, you know, not so much by design, but just because it happens through the pursuit of ISIS and through killing ISIS. This is what we ended up holding. Why is there this continuity despite two very, very different presidents? I think it's because the national security apparatus has been narrowed to a few key influential people who are deciding how this fight is to be fought, especially now, but also under President Obama. And what, as a result, what's ended up happening is, if you want to think past the day-to-day tactical military stuff, and you really want to define a long-term plan for the United States and Syria, or you want to come to terms with the risks that are involved in what we're doing in Syria, or you want to even define a desired end state. What is the end state we want to see as the United States and Syria? What are our interests as the United States and Syria, and how do we get them? That starts to sound a lot like a U.S. intervention in the Middle East, which is, of course, what it already is, but this sounds like it. That's difficult to do once you get more ambitious about what you want to do in terms of your objectives and your goals. It's also politically very unpopular to do, and no one wants to do it. But that is what we're doing, or rather, we're not doing it at our own expense without the benefit of the kind of reflection that should come with designing a policy in probably the riskiest spot in the world. I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Hi. Addressing the U.S. presence over the long term in Syria, we should ask what's going to happen in the presence in Iraq. And so what do you think?
Well, that's a very fair point, especially because it's the same problem insofar as ISIS is concerned. So in Iraq, there's already so much institutionally invested in that place that the jump from doing nothing to doing a lot is much shorter, because the Pentagon views Iraq as their baby. You know, they fought to keep this place from collapsing to the Iranians and to ISIS, ISI at the time. They lost a lot of soldiers. It's become kind of embedded in the national security mentality of the United States that this is a place that we can't afford to let go. So this is why when Mosul fell, there was such an immediate, rapid reaction, whereas I think half of Syria would have had to fall for the United States to have this reaction about ISIS. I think we're staying there indefinitely. And we have a government that we can in theory, cooperate with to achieve our interests, Haider al-Abadi's government. Whereas in Syria, we don't want to work with Assad. So without having a central government and without having an institutional historical presence in the country, the case is harder to make internally within Washington, D.C. But Iraq is easy. It's easy for the military to make, as long as they don't have to fight a shooting war, which they probably don't. Having said that, I don't think that's going to work. But because I think the Iranians are so far ahead of us in Iraq that it's almost no competition. But you know, that's just my forecast, you know?
The Kurds in Iraq, and they recently, where are the Kurds in Iraq? And then they recently voted for independence. What does that mean? What territory is that? And what's going to happen?
Yeah. Okay. So they have their own complex politics, but I'll situate it within the geopolitical issue, you know, of Syria, et cetera. So what they did was they voted in a referendum. They approved independence, but they're not independent. There's supposedly a long political process to get there. I think they'll skip it, but you know, that's in theory, that's what's going to happen. They are not the Kurds of Syria politically at all. So they're hostile to them. Although that hostility has to contend with the kind of pan-Kurdish solidarity of Kurdish independence in Western Iraq. At the operational level, they don't cooperate. And they're hostile in general on the balance. And the KRG, the ones declaring independence, have much, much better, infinitely better relationship with the Kurds, with the Turks rather, than do the Kurds of Syria, who Turkey sees as part of the PKK, International Terrorist Organization. The number one nuisance that this has created for the United States is it potentially complicates our anti-ISIS war, because it might create trouble in Iraq and weaken the anti-ISIS front, and it might complicate our relations with the local Kurds in Syria. So our first reaction to that was Brett McGurk, the architect of the Counter-ISIS Coalition, paid a visit to the Kurds there and told them, hold off on this referendum. We don't need the trouble. They didn't listen to him, obviously. But that tends to show you how it falls into our calculus.
It seems to me, from what you have said in your discussion about analyzing the conflict, it seems like every country wants a piece of the pie in Syria. As a Syrian native, knowing my native country and the cradle of civilization, it's really a conflict that everybody wants an interest there. And my second question is, I would say, whom do you think put the most of the blame on, especially my own opinion here, the Saudis, the neighbors of Syria, Turkey, that have their own interests too against the Kurds, and Saudis, who increased the influence of the radical movements on Qatar too. Didn't that make the conflict more complicated and to even stop the war at least and then have a peaceful settlement, which really made this situation the way it is now on the ground? Also, another comment. You mentioned that the same policy against ISIS by Barack Obama and President Trump. I don't think this way, because I see that the Obama administration did strengthen the influence of Iran in Syria, especially at the time when they were doing the nuclear agreement and things, while I think and I believe that the Trump administration is a lot different in that regard. And so could you comment a little bit? I know you said you don't want to give your own opinion.
No.
I respect that, but it's your own analysis.
No, I'm happy to give my opinion. I didn't want to preach my opinion from the podium, but I'm happy to answer your question. Yeah, absolutely. The piece of the pie comment? Yes, that's obviously true. So the question of blame, first of all, my own premise, and this is just my premise, I don't think a peaceful solution was possible for this conflict ever. So that's where I'm starting from. Now, if you take for granted that there's going to be a conflict, then you start thinking of, you know, the Saudis and Qataris and who they backed and did they back radical forces, then yes, of course, they made the situation worse without a doubt. And they also helped actually destroy the original opposition as it existed before it became whatever it is now. Whether I would blame them for the conflict or not, I think this is a conflict between two sides in a country that are irreconcilable in terms of politics, not in terms of sectarian whatever, in terms of what kind of state is it going to look like and who's going to control it. And that stuff happens. I mean, civil wars are civil wars, and other countries jump in, and yes, they made it worse. But I wouldn't lay the blame for the conflict on them. I think that's a bit much. But can you remember your third question? Oh, yeah, the continuity. Very quickly. No, I don't think these are identical presidents with an identical foreign policy about the region. I just think it's identical to ISIS, first of all. Second of all, at this stage now, even if Donald Trump wants to push back against the Iranians, and let's forget about Yemen and the Gulf, let's talk about Syria, because the other stuff is different. The risk involved in doing this in Syria right now is very high. So I have not seen an indication that they're willing to shoulder those risks, even if they actually would like to do it. Whereas I know that Barack Obama wouldn't have liked to do it. So I meant in the effect, it's turned out the same, not in the intent, if that makes any difference. But thank you for those thoughtful questions.
Hi, my question is about the U.S. role. So you said that the policymakers said that we don't want to get involved in the civil war and that this was insincere, but you said that they are doing this because they want to destroy ISIS. Are there other, what is the main role that the U.S., they've always been there, what is the main role that the U.S. is trying to do? Is it really just to destroy ISIS? Does it have anything to do with the gas lines? Is it to stop Iran? What is the role that you tried to highlight?
So we have to take a bit of a trip back in time, but I'll press fast forward as much as I can. The original policy of the United States was that Bashar al-Assad needs to step down from government through a negotiated settlement, and unofficially we're going to arm some CIA groups to make life a bit more difficult so he'll come around and understand that that's in his interest. That was the U.S. policy. But the U.S. policy also meant that we would not do that aggressively enough to risk a regime collapse and a collapse of Syrian institutions, because then we would be, or so it went, back in an Iraq situation, and we didn't want to own that problem. Fine. Obviously, this didn't work. It was a miscalculation, but that's what the policy was. Now, reality got ahead of that policy, because it became clear Bashar al-Assad was not going to do that, and the insurgency was getting out of the U.S. hands anyway. But our policy stayed the same, officially, under Barack Obama, even though it no longer made any sense, given what the situation on the ground was. So that finished, enter the ISIS problem. The ISIS problem was something we decided to disaggregate from the rest of the Syrian conflict and fight in isolation from it. And that's why the results have been a bit absurd. But nonetheless, we are there fighting a war. And that war is not about lining ISIS guys up and shooting them. It's about taking territory, taking resources, forming local coalitions, strengthening some groups at the expense of other groups. You are involved in a civil war. That's what a civil war is. So even if the only people we want to kill are ISIS people, that doesn't mean we're not a party to the civil conflict. That's the point I was trying to make.
Sir, thanks for coming. My question really revolves around your opinion. And what I'm coming at is, you were right when you said a lot of the countries there all want a piece of the pie. In particular, the Iranians are known to have a very long game that they play. And in particular, we know what they're doing right now with respect to the civil war in Syria, but maybe you could shed light on your opinion as to what is their long game overall, because they're there, they're investing a lot. What do they really want?
If you speak to the Iranian security apparatus, the people who run these wars, as opposed to the politicians they sent to Washington, these guys have a vision geostrategically for their country. They consider this a part of their sphere of influence, the Levant, especially Iraq, above all, but also Syria, to less extent, and Lebanon, because Hezbollah's there, and there's a big Shia population that has historic ties to the Iranian clerical establishment. So they don't see this as, they see it like we would see something that would happen in Central America. You know, we would have to make sure that if there was trouble there, we certainly can't afford for somebody hostile to take over that part. And we'd rather no one take it than somebody hostile, ideally someone we like, or at least we can trust. And this is where the Assad regime comes in. This is their kind of debt that connects them through the Levant to Lebanon, to Hezbollah, to two borders with the Israelis. It's also what protects them from a potential threat on their border in Iraq. So for them, Iraq is like the immediate anxiety point all the time, especially after the 8-year war they fought with Saddam. And then these are kind of buffer layers and the connection to Hezbollah. They are transparent about their intentions. I mean, they're not trying to make this place into Persia or convert everybody into Shia. They just want to make sure that whoever controls it is a friend, not an enemy. And this is where the war comes in. And they're doing it on the cheap. I mean, not a lot of Iranians are dying, very, very few. It's mostly kind of organizing local militias to take over this area and the area. It's the locals who are dying. But the Iranians get to dictate the general pace and structure of the conflict. And so far, it's working for them. I mean, it worked for them very well in Iraq. It's a bit more difficult in Syria because the core of the regime is a bit smaller than it is in Iraq. But they're still pulling it off. It's been very difficult. But they see this as something like they cannot afford to lose at all. It's not an option. Look, I think what they want with the Israelis is they want a deterrent. So they're not going to fight a war with the Israelis. They'll lose, first of all. Second of all, they could have done it a long time ago. They want to make sure that the Israelis understand that they are surrounded by the first line of defense, which is Lebanon and Syria. So if you hit us, we hit you here. That's a sort of gun they want to hold to their head to keep them aside. Otherwise, it's kind of rhetoric and whatever. But, I mean, there isn't going to be an interstate conflict between Syria, Israel, and Iran. If there is, they'll lose. So it's a bit more subtle than that, you know? If it doesn't have this kind of demonic element, it just makes sense for them strategically.
I'm going way back in history, and I'm just wondering if after World War I, if the British and the French hadn't set up all these arbitrary borders, do you think that the countries in that part of the world, or the group, the people in that part of the world, would have organized themselves into nations? Or would they have just, was there just too much tribal conflict and familial loyalties that this is inevitable, this kind of conflict?
Okay, I'm not going to be able to do justice to your question. But look, I think as a general rule, I'd be careful with this. But I do think that Iraq and Syria are exceptionally complicated and were set up in an exceptionally bad way. This is what I believe at the end of World War I. There are other nations that did much better. But it's not only a question of borders, it's also a question of how the Ottomans and the British and the French manipulated the balance of power inside these countries. Who they gave power to, they gave it to the Sunnis in Iraq, and they gave it to the Alawites in Syria, and then the Maronites in Lebanon, etc. And then there was a kind of reversal, and now here we still are. And Iraq, obviously, there's many, many more fault lines than just that. Does that mean I believe that they're doomed? No. But, you know, this part of the world was not going to be able to escape modernity. Modernity is borders and nations and states and flags. They were going to be hit with it eventually. They would have looked very different than it did now. But, you know, it's also now taken on a reality of its own. You know, Syrians will tell you we're Syrian and we feel Syrian. And even Iraqis, despite all that's happened to them, still say that. It's an interesting question. And I think, yes, they made mistakes. But I don't know how to get out of it now, you know. I guess you could partition the countries, as many, many people like to say we should do. But that's not that simple either. I mean, who goes where? And, you know, so what do we do with the Alawites? We put them in that mountain because that's where the Alawites originally came from. Or, you know, who gets the – it's easier said than done, and it creates new problems.
Could you talk about Jordan for a few minutes? Amman specifically, maybe, and what the population is and how it came to be what it is with refugees from three or four different countries over the years?
Okay. So how it came to be was the British felt that they had to give the Hashemite, the tribal, a kind of esteemed family from the Western Arabian Peninsula, something because they had deprived them and broken their promises with them about Syria and Iraq and Lebanon. So they created a nation called Transjordan. They armed it, and it basically acted as a British auxiliary force going after violent tribes in this area, pacifying them. All right, till 1948, creation of Israel, the place gets flooded with Palestinian refugees. It's about, I think, two-thirds Palestinian refugees now. And it's got something under maybe a million, just under a million Syrian refugees now. And they're, I mean, such a delicate, poor country that they're always trying to, the most risk-averse country in the region. So as a result, when it came to the Syrian conflict, they allied with the Americans and the CIA program in funding these rebel groups in the south the same time they were the first people to open up a channel to the Russians when they intervened in Syria in October 2015. So they're hedging. And now, for economic reasons, they want to resume relations with the regime, not because they like the regime, but because if the Americans aren't going to overthrow them, I'm not going to pay the price and lose money just because Barack Obama said, "Shut us, I should step down." So they're smart, to be honest, given the circumstances.
With all of the refugees in Turkey and Jordan and things calming down in Syria, what are the opportunities for people to be able to go home?
Oh, wow. You know, the refugee dynamic is so complicated and has so many layers and columns in it that it's not possible to speak of the refugees going home as such. A certain number of things would have to happen. First of all, they would have to have, contrary to intuition, it's not the poorest refugees who go home. It's actually the people who have a bit of means and of securing themselves, unless there's somebody to secure them on the other side, in which case, great, you know, but we're not there yet, obviously, and may never get there. They have to have something to go back to and a way of going back. They have to feel that there isn't going to be retaliation against them by the regime or whoever the hell's controlling whatever corner they're going back to. They're not going to want to, people who are from Homs are not going to want to go to Swaida and Deir ez-Zor. These places are Mars for them. So they want to go back to where they're from, or at least Damascus. But that, not only is there a physical destruction problem, and there is a physical destruction problem, there is a security problem. And there is also the problem of services. Who's going to provide for them? So there are 8 million, there are 11 million displaced refugees. About 5 million of them are outside the country. 6 million are inside the country. How does the Syrian government reabsorb these people into their economy, into their social network, welfare network? How does it provide security? There's a lot of people. And you're talking about a state that's been at war for 5 years that was never that effective anyway, and is now in trouble financially, relying on Russian and Iranian support just to be able to balance its budget. It's rolling back its subsidy programs. It's not in a position to do this. For this to happen, there would have to be an actual international agreement about the conflict, like what happened in Lebanon in 1990, the Taif Accords, for example, where there have to be a massive Russian investment, some guarantee of security. The problem is in Lebanon, that only happened because A, there was an international agreement to do it from all the major sides, and B, the Syrians occupied Lebanon and made everybody do it. So who's going to do it in Syria? Not the Syrian regime. They don't have that capacity. So international peacekeeping forces, that also requires a consensus. And we're not even having this conversation, is what I'm saying, in Washington, D.C. I mean, we're not thinking about how we're going to do that. That's not on the cards. The only people doing that are the aid development agencies, but they can't do anything if there's no political mandate. Sorry, the answer is depressing, but it's very, very, very disturbing. I mean, it's...
Thank you.